gesturing to the hatch, and he holds up one finger. He'll have it open in a minute. He can't see what I'm seeing. He finally gets the hatch open, and in the sudden bright overhead light, I can see the shapes more clearly. They're fish, moving in a tight school, as gaudily colored as inner circle ladies out for a night on the town. I just see them for a flash, and then they're gone, and all I see is Lachlan at the round open hatch. What is happening to me? The fresh air will clear my head. I can't wait to tear this rebreather off. I have to suck in every breath as if it's fighting me. My lungs feel heavy and sore. But before my head breaches the surface so I can take that yearned-for breath, Lachlan shoves me down again. He pushes up the hatch, kicking hard against the resistance of the water. He mimes something, and it is a long while before my fuzzy brain figures out that he's trying to tell me there's someone up there. We can't go out yet. But we have to. There's something wrong with my rebreather. I'm out of air. Have we been down here an hour? My perception is fuzzy. I don't know what I'm doing. All I know is that I have to breathe, and I can't with this thing over my face. I start to claw at it, pulling with desperate brute force at first, then trying to get my fingers between the bonded layers. Somewhere in the back of my mind, I know this is a terrible idea, but I can't help myself. Lachlan tries to stop me, but I fight him hard as if he's trying to drown me. That's what it feels like. Part of me can see his frantic eyes behind his own mask, but anything that keeps this suffocating film over my face has become the enemy. Finally, I tear it off, and as the water hits my face, I come to my senses. It's all I can do not to draw in a huge breath. I look through the water and see a blurry Lachlan inches away. He's doing something, ripping off his own mask. He comes closer. I feel his mouth on mine. He's giving me his air, his last breath, helping me hold on. I feel a moment of relief, instantly clouded by the twin thoughts that there is no more air after this for me, or for Lachlan. I want to tell him something. Bubbles escape my mouth, and the words are lost to the water. Then he wrenches the hatch open and shoves me upward. I grab the ring. My head breaches the surface, and I gasp, the first heavenly breath stinging my lungs. I suck in another, and another, before my head clears enough that I remember Lachlan. He went so far back under in his effort to push me to the surface. I start to try to dive under the water to help him, knowing that I'm more likely to drown him than to help him. But without the rebreather, I feel like I'm drowning as soon as my face hits the water. I can't do it. I kneel at the edge and peer over. He used the last of his air, his strength, to save me. I can see him far below the surface, indistinct. Is he moving? Is he trying? He saved me when I was drowning in the nanosand. Lachlan! I call in despair, and plunge my hands helplessly into the water. There's nothing I can do. He's just a dim shape far beneath the water, sinking deeper every moment. Suddenly, there's another shape there. In a confusion of movement, I see a shadow appear and merge with him. The shapes get bigger. They're coming up. There's someone else down there, pushing Lachlan to the surface. The second he's close enough, I reach down and grab whatever I can reach. His clothes, his hands, his hair, fumbling for anything to hold onto, and pull him up. His rescuer pushes from below and scrambles out herself, pulling off her rebreather as she stands, dripping. Lark, I gasp. You were supposed to stay behind. Stay safe. She gives me a soft smile. Do you really think I'd let you go into danger alone? I look down at Lachlan, choking up water at our feet. I want to say that I wasn't alone, but I let it go. More quietly, Lark adds. It's my fault your mother was killed. It's my fault Ash was captured. I made the mistake of trusting someone. Now I have to win back your trust. Oh, Lark, I breathe. But there isn't time for more. Lachlan is struggling to his knees. He looks up at Lark, a strange mix of gratitude and hostility in his eyes. "You're not supposed to be here," he says. I can tell he's deeply embarrassed at having to be rescued. He's always been the fighter, the strong one. Lark just shrugs. "Well, I am here. Good thing, too." "You can't come inside with us," he insists. "You don't fit into our plan." "Luckily, I have a plan of my own," she says flippantly. There is a row of lockers against the far wall. She takes out a sealed package, tears it open, and slips on a set of pale green coveralls. She hides her lilac hair under a cap, and flashes an ID. "I'll pick up some tools and things I need in another supply closet, and be waiting for you right outside the holding cells. I won't be able to get any closer than that, but I'll be ready for anything." "You can't," Lachlan begins, but I cut him off. I know arguing with her is useless at this point. The only thing left to do is make sure she's in a good position. A safe position. "You can't be so close, or you'll be affected too. Wait for us near the lobby. We may need your help there." If all goes according to plan, we can make it out without anyone the wiser. I'm hoping not to involve Lark anymore at all. After Lachlan, Ash, and I get out, she can slip out on her own, shed her disguise, and go home. I need her to be safe. I don't think I can go through with all the hard things ahead of me if I can't picture Lark in her bedroom, lying on her mulberry-colored bed, safe and secure. I latch onto this future, trying not to think about the in-between. After all, we only just made it inside, and we already almost died. "That's okay," Lark says. "I have a couple of tricks up my sleeve. If you get in trouble, I'll be able to provide a distraction." I envision her screaming to draw green shirt eyes, or even fighting. "Don't draw attention to yourself," I insist. She pulls the cap down lower. "No one will even notice me," she says with utter confidence. She looks exactly like an ordinary maintenance worker. So she might be right. My clothes are dry, thanks to the automatic seal on the exposure suit that bonded to my skin as soon as the mask was breached. Most of my hair is even still dry. When I ripped the mask off, the hood section of the suit bonded instantly to the skin around my hairline. For a second, I marvel at the technology humans can create. How did we get to be so powerful, but so destructive? With so much intelligence, couldn't we see the point past which one begets the other? We dressed for the mission in the typical gray suits of the Center Elite. The pants are slim, light steel-colored, with the faintest iron-hued pinstripes. The high-necked, form-fitting jackets just a shade darker, layered over a black shirt for him, an iridescent, silvery mother-of-pearl for me. I don't know about myself, but he looks the very image of every young center official I've ever seen on news vids. Except for that scar on his face. That might raise suspicions. That, and the perpetually rakish look in his second-child eyes. He covers them with green-tinted glasses. The kind, he says, are popular with pretentious young bureaucrats on the rise. "You have to look more serious," I insist, as I tie my own hair into a businesslike knot at the back of my head. The colors Lark added are mostly hidden, and with the severe hairstyle, I know I can pass for at least a few years older. He immediately assumes an intensely bland face. "Better?" I can't help but chuckle, my default mode around Lachlan, no matter how terrible the circumstances. We might have just come close to death, and capture, maybe worse than death, looms ahead of us as a very real possibility. But somehow he can always make me smile. Are other people like that? Somehow, I don't think so. How is it he can always make me happy, no matter how bad things get? I catch Lark watching our interaction, and I bend my head, flushing. Then I straighten defiantly. What's wrong with having two friends? Why can't two people make me happy? I had so little for so long. I think I'm entitled to have both Lark and Lachlan. without them getting prickly whenever I pay too much attention to either. But now isn't the time to dwell on that. I steel myself, as I've learned to do, and together we head up the long, narrow steps first to the official sub-basements. There, Lark branches off from us, to gather the tools that'll be part of her cover, and wait for us in the main lobby. She blows me a kiss as we separate. I see Lachlan try to hide a scowl. Lachlan and I then go to the data storage floors, and finally, to the ground floor, the headquarters of all Center Law and Security. We've made it so far without incident. My father's security card buzzes us through every barrier, and the few people we've passed hardly glance at us. Lower down, I think most of the people were just trying to finish jobs that had taken longer than expected so they could go home. They were maintenance types and lower-level data clerks, who probably wanted nothing to do with what we appeared to be. Powerful young officials on the rise. People who could make trouble for them, assign them extra tasks, criticize their work. So they lowered their eyes, pretended we didn't exist, and hoped we showed them the same courtesy. Here on the ground floor, though, things get harder. Now we have to make sure our story is perfect. We went over it as many times as possible before we broke in, so I'd know exactly what to do. Lachlan, buoyant with confidence, explained that even though the center was the most secret and secure place in Eden, it relied far more on technology than on people. "If your card scans, you're legitimate," he said. "They trust the Ecopan. If the Ecopan believes we belong here, no one else will question us. Thanks to your father's ID, one of the highest-ranking center officials is simply making a tour of the facilities or taking care of secret business. There's no cross-reference, no body scans at this level. They won't analyze me and figure out that I'm 30 pounds lighter and 30 years younger than the owner of the ID." There was a complex assortment of scans and checks at the main entrances. Biometric readings, lens scans, all sorts of detectors. But we had neatly bypassed all of those by going through the sewer. Once a person was in the building, they were in the clear. It was assumed that the Ecopan had done its job. Anyone inside was one of the privileged, the elite. "So, even if our faces are unfamiliar," Lachlan told me, "we'll be accepted. They'll think we work another shift, or we're new, or the children of someone so important they don't dare question us. Students who are children of the elite often get internships here, or high-level jobs straight out of school. So no one is surprised if we look a bit young." "People underestimate the power of expectations," Lachlan whispers to me as we make our way toward the prison section of the security floor. "We don't have to prove we belong here. We simply have to be here." In a strange circular logic, our presence is proof of our right to be here. We're climbing the spiral staircase to the second floor. It is a strangely beautiful architectural touch, broad and lovely as a bisected seashell. Strong light streams into the lobby, the only part of the center most civilians ever see, and everything is white, bright, with blue accents and touches of green, like a seaside. A waterfall feature cascades down from the second floor to the first, right behind the spiral staircase, flowing an unreal shade of aqua. Three tiny clean bots scurry around the pool at the base, mopping up the few drops of water that splash onto the floor. So far, so good. When the spiral turns and lets us into the security section of the center, all that beachy brightness is stripped away. This place is bare. Sere. I'd almost call it gritty if it wasn't so clean. The entire tone has changed. Of the building and the people. I glance down to the lobby floor to see an innocuous maintenance worker pushing a wheeled cart full of tools and buckets across the atrium. Only the slight build clues me into the fact that it's Lark. I wish she'd look up, give me the brief reassurance of her bright gaze. But she's too sensible for that, and I tear my own eyes quickly away. We pass a check-in desk with little more than a word from Lachlan and a wave through. somberly, seriously. We move through corridors that Lachlan mapped out from the underground's intelligence, and water system schematics that Lark provided. Now we go down a narrow hallway that feeds into a large chamber. I hear the sounds of human misery, subdued, but evident. I smell something I can't identify. Subtle and sharp, that makes my skin prickle. Maybe it is the smell of fear. I stop abruptly. There are prison cells lining the walls. "Remember who you are," Lachlan says under his breath. By which he means, remember who I'm supposed to be. A young psychology student with her center guide, come to interview the renegade Ash about why he would betray his home, his very species. My knowledge, through my father, of the workings of high-level center medicine will allow me to answer at least the most basic questions anyone might throw at me. I think the me I'm pretending to be would still be surprised at this. I've seen the violent side of Eden, but I haven't seen it institutionalized. Walls and bars. Through some of them I see fingers straining. For what? For aid? For food? For freedom? Civics vids always talk about how there's so little crime in Eden. Who would steal, or kill, when to steal is to take food from the entire human species? To kill is to end a statistically staggering percentage of the surviving human population. I suppose there aren't many prisoners in comparison to the entire population of Eden. I can see maybe 100 cells, spreading along in diminishing perspective down the long rectangular room. But there are far too many for a society that claims to be a utopia. I wonder how many people, normal people, know about this place. Two burly guards stand at the entrance. I expect them to be armed, but oddly, they aren't. "We're here to see Prisoner 89, Lachlan says brusquely, twirling a pen cleverly around his fingers. There's another stuck behind his ear. "You're not on the list," one of the guards says without moving. "Request should have been forwarded while we were en route." Lachlan sounds supremely bored, and adds a yawn for good measure. "Overtime for me. Firing for my secretary." He shrugs, and gestures to me over his shoulder with his thumb. "I have to shepherd this one around to make the boss happy." He lowers his voice conspiratorially. "Boss's pet." He winks, and I look uncomfortable. Not a hard act under the circumstances. "Do you need him out of the cell?" the guard asks. Lachlan looks at me, and I play my part. Saying primly, "The psychology of the deranged mind cannot be properly explored through bars." I fiddle with the clipboard in my hands, taking out the attached pen and slipping it back again. "It is important to understand what inspires these societal aberrations, so that we can nip such actions in the bud." I hope I sound like a pure academic without any motivations beyond proving myself to my lead professor. I practice the pedantic tone a lot. I see Lachlan roll his eyes. "Wants to rehabilitate him, probably." "Too late for this one," I snap. "But maybe we can help other people before they go astray." Lachlan clenches his hand and pummels his other palm. "There's only one way to correct people like this," he says. "The fist if you catch them early, and a more terminal solution if the fist doesn't work." The guards laugh, and, recognizing a like-minded man and the young official Lachlan pretends to be, waves us through to another man, who waves a handheld device over us, checking us for weapons. I assumed we'd bring the guns, but Lachlan said no. "No weapons are allowed in the secure area, not even for the guards." Lachlan says this will make everything easier. "When there are weapons, people die, and some of those people might be us. All we have to do is get Ash out of his cell." The guard escorts us to a stark room that is bare except for two chairs, a table with built-in hand restraints, and a dark, tinted window I can't see through. "Wait here," he says. "I'll bring the prisoner to you." "Lachlan," I whisper. "There will be someone watching." I tilt my head toward the window. And if he's handcuffed to the table...
Shh,
he cautions. It just means we'll have to act right away. The original plan was to pretend to interrogate him until we were sure the guards were in the right position. I thought I had a few minutes to brace myself, to take a few more deep breaths. I'm not ready for this. But I have to be. We have to do it outside, in the main room, Lachlan says, so we step out of the interview chamber. Psst, I hear from the cell next to the interview room. Lachlan shakes his head. Don't get involved. Focus, he seems to project. But I can't help looking. It's a small, portly man I don't recognize. He's dressed in a gray prison uniform, and there are marks on the exposed skin of his face and hands that look like burns. He creeps up to me, then says the most frightening thing of all. I know who you are. My eyes fly open wide in horror. He's speaking in a low voice now, but all he has to do is shout, get a guard's attention, and we're done for. What do you want? I hiss. To my dismay, he starts to blubber. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to tell them, I swear. He might know me, but I have no idea who he might be. Who are you? He says a name I don't know. Clayton Hill. Then he adds, you look so much like your mother. And your brother. I'm so sorry she was killed. It's all my fault. Tears stream down his pudgy cheeks. I didn't even hold out very long. I couldn't. They... He holds up his hands, showing the burn marks. They told me she was killed. That was worse than the torture. She was such a lovely person. Such a big, kind heart. Can it be? You're... the center official who was helping her. He holds his hands through the bars in supplication now. Forgive me, please. Forgive me for not being strong enough. It wasn't Lark. It wasn't her fault. The bitterness that had consumed me at the thought that she, however inadvertently, brought about Mom's death, evaporates. I have to force myself to turn away, because the guard is bringing Ash out now. His hands are bound behind his back, his pale, confused face bruised. He's staggering. The guard has to hold him up. Is he drugged? For a second, his bleary eyes see nothing. Then he seems to wake up. In a horrible moment, before I can flash him a warning gesture, before he can figure things out for himself, he blurts out, Rowan? What are you doing here? Beck! The guards flanking Ash look confused. We could probably play it off. Say he was drugged, confused, or attempting a ruse. That he's never seen me before. But suspicions once roused are hard to quell. And we only have one chance at this. We had a plan. Such a good plan. But if there's one thing I've learned in the last few days, it's that plans almost always change. Lachlan lowers his trendy green-tinged specs and looks at me over the rims with his beautiful second-child eyes. Ready? He mouths. My hand goes to the pearls at my throat, and I just barely nod. As if we choreographed the move for weeks instead of talking it out for a few scant hours, Lachlan lunges at Ash's face with the pen he's been twiddling all this time. The guards, probably thinking Lachlan is trying to assassinate the prisoner, reach for the pen. But suddenly, it isn't a pen anymore. At the exact same time, my fingers clench around my short strand of pearls and rip them violently away from my throat. I hurl them to the hard floor, and they bounce and roll all around the open room that is ringed with cells. Some skip into the entranceway, where more guards are waiting. I see uniformed men and women looking down at the innocent-looking little pearls. Until suddenly, they're not pearls anymore. I pull my pen that isn't a pen from my clipboard and press it to my face, where it unrolls itself into a bioadhesive sheet similar to the one in the hazmat suit's mask. It presses itself to my face, sealing my eyes, nose, and mouth with just a little gap so I can see and don't feel like I'm choking. A chemical reaction will give me air for about 10 minutes, which should be enough. Through the haze of the protective film, I can see that Lachlan has his mask on too. Then, with a subtle series of pops, the pearls detonate and release their bursts of toxic gas. I can feel it on my skin. Coldness as sharp as if I'd stepped into a freezer. But the drug itself won't be absorbed through my skin, only through the lungs and eyes. As the guards are beginning to find out. I remember the smell so well, and almost wish I could breathe it in one more time. With my new eyes, my new mission, I might never again see that glorious camphor tree that gives the underground second children hope, happiness. And after a little bit of chemical tweaking, an aerosolized plant-based poison capable of taking out a room full of people. Nature gives life, and nature gives death. And what are we humans but a part of nature? It all seems to go perfectly. Lachlan was sure we'd be able to smuggle in the cleverly disguised technology. And he was right. He was certain the camphor-based drug could disable anyone who breathed it in. And he was right. The guards are choking, vomiting, collapsing. Lachlan told me they'll recover, eventually. But looking at how quickly the guards go from health to misery, to stillness. I wonder if he just told me that so I wouldn't think about having more deaths on my conscience. In seconds, every guard in our sight is on the ground. This is our moment. We need to run. Now. Downstairs and out the front door. Just 3 panicked employees, fleeing a terrorist attack. We'll get into the car that Lachlan's people will have stolen and left parked outside the center, so we can get away as quickly as possible. Within an hour, Ash should be in the underground. Safe. But there was one thing I didn't plan for. Beatings. Drugging. Stress. Terror. Ash isn't strong at best. Now, through the bioadhesive film over his face, I can see the panic in his eyes that heralds one of his attacks. He's starting to wheeze. His breath a muffled whistle behind the mask. He looks at me in apology for one instant, and then his knees buckle. Our plan relied on a quick exit. Now one of us can't run. Lachlan doesn't hesitate. He strips a jacket from one of the fallen guards and drapes it over Ash, hiding his cuffed hands, so that at first glance, he looks like a guard, not a prisoner. "Go!" Lachlan shouts, and picks up Ash as if he weighed nothing, slinging him over his shoulders. We run, out past the fallen guards, to the spiral staircase, the camphor essence making my exposed skin tingle. Over the railing, I can see people on the first floor looking up in alarm. "Help us!" I shout, my desperate, terrified expression, not an act at all, as I gesture wildly behind us. "There's been an attack! They're all dead!" I barrel down the stairs and toward the front door. There aren't as many people as there would have been in the daytime, but there are enough to make a panicked crowd, as most run for the exit and a few head up the stairs toward the chaos. No one seems to notice me. I must look as alarmed and confused as everyone else. But a few people are looking suspiciously at Lachlan as he struggles a little bit behind me with Ash over his shoulder. I see a woman point to him, say something to a nearby man. They look around, and the woman beckons urgently to someone I can't see. Lachlan is slowed by Ash's weight, and only halfway down the stairs. We're far enough apart that anyone seeing us wouldn't think we were together. I want to look at him, to call, hurry up. But I don't dare attract more attention. I keep walking, slowly across the wide-open lobby toward the door. Moving almost sideways, pretending to look up at the commotion on the second floor like almost everyone else is doing. Then I see who the woman was beckoning to. A green shirt appears, heading toward the couple and at the same time scanning the lobby to see what they're talking about. He has a gun on his belt, and I have no way of knowing if it's the lethal kind. It doesn't really matter. Killed or stunned, if we're hit, we're done for. Whatever the people say convinces him. He starts striding across the lobby toward the stairs Lachlan is laboriously trudging down,
Stop right there!
When Lachlan doesn't react, the green shirt starts to run straight for the stairs. I don't know what to do. I take a step toward them, not knowing if I'm going to run to help Lachlan and Ash, or attack the green shirt. I hesitate too long. I realize I can't make it to either of them in time. Lachlan is almost at the bottom of the stairs. The green shirt is almost on him. His hand goes for his gun. Then I see the maintenance worker near the pool at the base of the decorative waterfall tumbling from the second to the first floor. She raises her head, meeting my eyes with a quick, worried, loving look that somehow reminds me of my mom. My heart seems to dissolve within me, making me weak. I know that look. Mom wore it just before she sacrificed her life for mine.
No!
I cry out, sure that Lark is going to do something foolishly, fatally, nobly heroic to save us all. She is. I just underestimate her resourcefulness. In one swift motion, she pulls a heavy wrench from her tool cart and latches it onto a gear in a control panel hidden at the far side of the fountain. With a grunt of effort, she torques it counterclockwise. For a sickening second, nothing happens. Then I hear a rumbling from somewhere over my head. Suddenly, the water at the top of the waterfall erupts in a foamy rush, 10 times the volume, flooding down in a powerful arc to the first floor. It sweeps across the lobby in a gushing river, knocking the green shirt off his feet and sweeping him ludicrously on his back halfway across the lobby. 12 other people go down, foundering in the knee-high water. I'm far enough away that the water just splashes my toes. Lachlan, still on the stairs with Ash, watches in apparent amusement as the green shirt floats by. Then he looks at Lark and grins. Her face is hidden by her cap, all but her curling lips. I see them smile back for an instant before she squats down and pretends to be fixing the malfunction instead of acting as a saboteur. Somehow, that quick interaction between them makes my heart lighter. We make it to the door before we seem to attract any more notice. Everyone has their hands full with toxic gas and floods. An alarm sounds, but no one seems to know exactly what it's for. I see a guard coming down the stairs. Bick, it's the man who let us in. He's choking, clutching his throat, but still standing. He must have been out of range of the worst of the camphor toxins. He points at us, shouts, but there's too much confusion, and no one seems to know what he's saying. He starts to chase us himself, holding tightly to the railing as he staggers down the stairs. The only thing in our favor now is that the guards on the prison level don't carry weapons. Otherwise, he would have shot us already. Lachlan catches up, but we've lost precious seconds. Where's the car? I ask. It's nowhere to be seen. And now we have another problem. Lachlan, I don't think Ash is breathing. I'm not completely sure. It's hard to see at his odd angle, slung over Lachlan's shoulders. But I don't see him breathing. Can't see his chest rise and fall. I pull his mask off, my own too, gasping as we make our way toward the street, searching desperately for the car. Ash's eyes are closed. He's pale. I slap his cheek, but there's no response. If he's breathing at all, it is terribly shallow and weak. We have to get him to a doctor. I know Lachlan has connections. He must know a safe place to take Ash. Even Flame might be able to help him. Even... my father can help him.
No, we stick to the plan, he gasps. The underground.
But he needs help. This is all for him.
They're too close. We have to get underground fast. If we stay on the surface, they'll track the car and catch us.
If he dies, I won't help you,
I cry, desperate. Lachlan grinds his teeth but doesn't answer. We're around the side of the center now, and there's no one near us. They're all in the front, escaping, milling.
There it is,
Lachlan shouts, and makes his labored way to the waiting car. I can hear the guard coming after us, but I don't dare spare the extra second to turn around and check how close he is. Lachlan shoves Ash into the car and dives toward the driver's seat. He's expecting me to follow, and flips on the manual override without looking back at me.
He's right. The guard is too close, bearing down on us. If he can't stop the car, he'll call in a description and have all of Eden after us. Ash will never make it to medical help. Not to his secret contacts. Or Flame. Or my father. We need to get Ash away without this guard letting the city know exactly what to look for.
Are you in?
Lachlan shouts without turning around, gunning the engine.
Yes,
I call back. He hears the door slam and jets off. But I'm not inside. I'm running at full speed toward the guard. We crash into each other. He's big, as solid as the trunk of the camphor tree. And any other time I know I would have just bounced off of him. But he inhaled at least some of the camphor poison, and he's weak, off balance. We both go down. For a second, he's on top, and he's so heavy, I think I don't have a chance. His hands close around my throat, cold from the camphor in the air. And I tuck my chin and push at him in vain. But then he starts coughing, so violently that he lets me go, and I manage to shove him off me and get to my feet. Maybe he'll pass out. Maybe I won't have to hurt one more person. But the universe isn't that kind. The coughing fit passes. He drags himself weakly to his knees, reaching for me. I'm sorry, I whisper, before I kick him in the side of the head. The sound is sickening. He crumples flat on the ground. I don't know if he's alive or dead. The important thing, I have to tell myself, is that he can't give a description of the car. The little vehicle is long gone. That gives Lachlan a chance to get away. That gives Ash a chance to get medical care. I've done it. I've saved my brother. I wonder if Lachlan has even noticed I'm not there yet, or if he's too focused on driving. I feel strangely free, as if I've done everything that is expected of me, and can finally rest. I even feel, and this is something I never expected, almost relieved that Lachlan is driven away, that Lark has by now no doubt found her own stealthy way out, and I'm all alone again. It's normal for me to be alone. The status quo. I always hoped my solitude would end one day, but all this time with people has been draining. Now Lark is gone. And Ash. And Lachlan. And everyone who matters in my life. I'm alone. And I feel strong. I'm not alone for long, though. A moment later, 5 or 6 green shirts round the corner spy me in the fallen guard, and start shooting. And I, as always, start running. I hear a rumble, and the world around me seems to shiver. I ignore it. There have been far too many strange visions dancing before my eyes lately for me to pay this one any mind. At this particular moment, it might be real. It might not. It doesn't matter. Running is the only thing that matters. There's enough confusion in the center that I manage to make a quick break and slip into darkness before they can catch me. After that, I make my way quickly toward the outer circles. I don't know how to find the entrance to the underground, and I'm not sure if I should go there anyway. There's no immediate sign of pursuers, but they'll find me eventually. I can't risk leading them to the hidden second children. I can go to Serpentine, maybe. No, that's been compromised. The soup kitchen? Yes, that's my best bet. If I survive the night, I might have a chance of blending in there. And people there have connections to the underground. But my hopes of reaching it are slim. I'll die tonight. Of that, I'm fairly certain. The lull and lack of pursuit at the moment don't deceive me. How many times have I beat the odds, racing through Eden? This is the night my luck won't hold. But it's okay, I tell myself. I've saved Ash, so part of me will live on in my brother. And all those second children will live on. Maybe Lachlan won't have me in my lenses anymore, but he's resourceful and dedicated. He'll always find a way to keep the second children alive and safe. Acceptance of mortality is liberating. I start taking risks. If I'm doomed, why not save my feet and take an auto loop? I have the eyes for it now. Feeling reckless, I skip down the stairs to a station and let the scanner check my eyes. It blinks, sending me through. Whoever I am now, whoever I'm supposed to be, I must have credits on my account. I'm welcomed. I smile at the few people riding on the auto loop, looking them boldly in the eye. They seem uncomfortable with my boldness. They never dream that I'm an imposter. I ride all the way to the second outermost circle and exit with a feeling of lightness. Heaviness, worry, are for people whose fate is uncertain. Dawn is coming, lightening the east, and I look around, marveling at the beauty that surrounds me. Yes, beauty, though I wouldn't have noticed it in any other state. Last time I was here, fearing for my life, I only saw squalor and poverty. Now I notice how the rosy light touches the edges of the buildings, how the quickening breeze stirs up dust in eddies that look like something undersea. Now that I'm resigned to leave it, the world seems lovely. It should make me sad, shouldn't it? Now I'm just glad to have been part of it. Even a small part, for just a little while. There's the food pantry, but I see someone who looks suspicious. It's probably just a hungry man waiting for them to serve breakfast. But it could also be a center official undercover. So I don't even glance at the soup kitchen, but just walk past. He doesn't follow me. Good. Because it's not that I want to die or anything. I hope I can get to safety, get back in touch with Lachlan, see my brother again, spend long hours talking to Lark, resume my spying mission. I just hope it in a hopeless kind of way. I think about doubling back and seeing if I can get into the soup kitchen unobserved after all. It will be full light soon, and I'll lose the advantage the darkness and dim dawn have given me so far. Then I have a better idea. I'll leave Eden entirely. Why not spend the day in the forest of synthetic bean trees? It will be safe and cool. Maybe it will even occur to Lachlan that I'll go there. Maybe he'll come and find me. I know they're coming before I see or hear them. How? It's like a little switch goes on in my brain. Like I'm seeing the scene from somewhere else. On a data block screen, maybe. Close, but far away. I see myself, tiny. I see myself being spotted by a group of green shirts turning slowly with their handheld scanners. As if I'm watching from above, I see them all focus in my direction and start to move toward me. It's just a paranoid feeling, I tell myself. How could I see them as if through the eye of a bot or a security camera? I have to be imagining it, but I start to run again anyway. There's the wall of junk, piled high. Another wall to keep me in. Or out. I recognize the place I managed to crawl through the last time, and I'm on my belly, wiggling when the green shirts shout. She's over here someplace! Do you see her? Scanner says 100 yards or less. Of course they can scan me now. I have lenses. Real lenses that link to the Ecopan. They don't know I'm Rowan, but they must have scanned me at the center. And now it is all a relatively simple matter to have the cameras and bots that all connect to the Ecopan looking for me. In becoming a first child, I've lost my anonymity. There she is, one of them calls out, just before my legs wiggle all the way into the dense pile of refuse. I move as quickly as I can, but I must take a slightly different route and I'm blocked in. I double back, but they started to crawl after me. I hear a hum, and I think it must be in my head. Another weird symptom. Are my lenses humming now? As well as giving me visions? For long moments more, I crawl through the twisted junk, the refuse of civilization. I can hear clattering behind me, but I still have hope. They might get lost in the labyrinth of garbage. They might get trapped. But then, so might I. I've lost all sense of direction. Right now I'm just crawling away from the sounds of pursuit. That seems like the best bet right now. Then I hear more sounds, rattling from all around me. I'm surrounded. But how?
Finally, I see an opening ahead, and I wiggle toward it. If I can get out ahead of them and run, then the ground begins to shift under me. There is no ignoring it, no denying it. The entire earth heaves up, like it's breathing a huge sigh of exasperation at the humans crawling across it. The first movement is almost gentle. It is the last gentle thing for a very long time. With a violent, jarring punch, the entire earth seems to throw me upward against the trash, then throw me down again. Things start to collapse on my head. From the shouts and agonized wails behind me, I can tell the pursuing green shirts aren't so lucky. One cry is abruptly cut off. Someone shouts for someone named Wolf and gets no answer. Piteously, one calls for his mother. I get half of my body out of the wall of trash, and then another mighty heave of the earth lifts me, and everything, up high, and brings us crashing down again. I hear a terrible creak above me, and drag myself forward, not even daring to look up. There's a deafening crash, and a huge beam shifts and pins my leg. I scream, my cries of pain joining those of the surviving green shirts. At first, I'm sure my leg must be broken. Even severed, it hurts so much. But as I pull, I realize it's just painfully trapped at the thigh. Not that that's much better. If the green shirts don't find me, I'll die a slow death of dehydration. My head is clear of the tangle. The beanstalk forest is just in front of me, the massive tree-like constructs moving gently in the wind. No, not the wind. Some of the giant bean trees are shifting from the roots up. I watch as the ground buckles, liquefies around a clump of them nearest to me. Then I see in horror what is happening. In slow motion, three of the mechanical behemoths begin to tilt. Slowly, with a grinding, creaking sound, they topple, right toward me. I scream again, begging for help I know will never come, and I pull with all my strength, but my leg remains wedged under the beam. With my lips curled back in a primal snarl of fear and rage against my coming end, I watch the three bean trees gain momentum as they crash toward me. Two of them cross, bouncing and sliding off each other, sending the massive trunks in two different directions. But the third is listening directly toward me. I want to meet my fate directly, with strength, or at the very least with anger. But to my shame, I cover my head at the last second. The booming crash deafens me, the sound alone so painful I almost think I've been crushed. Instead, the weight miraculously lifts from my leg, and I instinctively squirm free of the tangle. Only when I've crawled breathlessly away do I see that the bean tree fell at just the right angle to seesaw the crushing beam off my leg. But it isn't over yet. Not by a long shot. Trees are falling all around me. I drag myself to my feet and try to run, but the ground buckles under me, falling away from my feet, and I have to crawl. The earth is spitting the artificial trees out, tearing the fake things from her breast and casting them on the ground. Under the ground there are cables and wires, all useless now in the face of the earth's own awesome force. Spellbound, on my knees like a supplicant, I watch them fall. All around me they crash, closer and closer as I desperately try to find my balance on the shifting ground. I try to tuck my feet under me and jump away, but the earth seems to have turned liquid, as bad as the nanosand in the desert. I flop and flail helplessly, trying to get away as the huge, twisted trunk crashes toward me, but I can't maneuver. I curl my body and throw my arms over my head. I expect it to die tonight, but not like this. I feel the whoosh of air, hear a crash so loud I can't hear anything else for a few minutes, as the tree snags on another tree's vine and lands just a few feet to my side. Another miss. I use the monstrous leaves to pull myself out of the heaving, devouring earth and on top of the stalk. The shaking has lessened, but the ground around me is like a sea and the trees keep falling. I run, slipping and sliding on the broad, gnarled trunks, dodging other beanstalks as they fall. when the heat of the desert smacks me in the face. I turn behind me and find a ruin. At least half of the synthetic beanstalks are down. I don't even want to think what this will mean for Eden. The algae spires and the photosynthetic material impregnated in all the buildings make oxygen too. But is it enough? Without these beanstalks, will Eden suffocate? I see movement on the far side of the massive deadfall of collapsed bean trees. Two of the green shirts made it through the wall and are picking their way over the tangled trunks and vines. I don't know whether to be relieved or disappointed. I think of the man crying out for his mother, and want to run to the survivors, to see if they're okay, if I can help rescue their comrades. But I don't, because the world doesn't work like that, and people don't think like that. We're not altruistic. Humans fight and kill and follow orders, and the only way to survive is to be like everyone else, only worse. They don't ask for help, or see if I'm okay. We don't find common ground in the face of this catastrophic earthquake. We just keep fighting, running, hurting, killing. They open fire at me, and I run into the desert. There's nowhere else to go. It's as awful as I remember. The heat smacks me like an explosion. Each breath scorches my lungs. But I keep going, because the green shirts keep shooting. Why do they care about duty at a moment like this, with the ground trembling beneath our feet? Or are they so persistent because they blame me for their comrades' deaths? But they don't have to chase me, shoot at me. It's not me making them do it. Don't they realize they could just stop? But I can't. I have to keep running out into this brutal oven while they do their best to kill me for reasons none of us fully understand. And the nanosand is coming. Now that I know what to look for, I can see it. It shimmers just a little, setting it apart from the matte dun color of the rest of the sand. There's a patch behind me, and one to my left. Maybe another ahead of me, I can't quite tell. They're moving at the pace of a brisk walk, swimming through the sea of sand directly toward me. The quaking has stopped for the moment, and I can move faster than the nanosand pools for now. But there are more now, two coming from the right, and I know however fast I'm traveling now, the heat will make me slow down soon. They'll surround me, swallow me down. My skin is scorched pink, so hot I don't even sweat. I stumble to one knee but scramble up again right away. For a moment I look at the two green shirts standing on the edge of the desert. They don't dare follow me. Smart men. What if I just walk toward them? Will they shoot me the moment I'm in range? Will they talk to me about how ridiculous it is that we three of the few surviving humans on the planet want to kill each other? The nanosand slithers inexorably closer. Uncertain, I raise my hand to the tiny, distant figures standing on the edge of the ruined beanstalk forest. I see one of them start to raise a hand, too. To wave? To beckon me in? Or to shoot at me again? Before I can decide, the earth decides for me. I hear a terrible grinding, cracking, exploding sound. And in the most powerful tremor of all, the ground rises at least 10 feet, throwing me down on my belly. From my new high vantage point, I think I see the earth beginning to smile, a fierce grin of jagged, rocky teeth. Another vision from my lenses? No. The earth really is splitting, opening up in a fissure 50 feet wide. As I watch, it stretches from the desert toward Eden, traveling like an arrow toward the center. I see a brilliant green flash at the heart of Eden, so bright it burns an afterimage on my retinas. And then, from one blink to another, the world changes. As if by magic, all the heat is sucked out of the air. The glaring white light dims to pinkish morning sunshine, rosy and comforting. As the ground shivers and grows still again, I see the merciless desert change to a mere strip of sand. It's cool beneath my hands. I look down at my palms, scorched and blistered from touching the sand just a moment ago. A soft wind begins to blow from out beyond the desert, cooling my skin. I look around me. The shimmering nanosand is gone. I smell something, sharp and strange and compelling, carried on the fresh breeze. It reminds me a little bit of the camphor tree, wild and peaceful all at once. I turn toward the scent, eager. In this sudden calm, the terror of the earthquake, of my escape and pursuit, are forgotten. On the far horizon, where before I only saw the shimmer of rising desert heat, I see a smudge of green. I take a step toward it. Another. Then I'm running. Not away from something for the first time in forever, but toward something. Some spark, some nerve hidden deep within me hopes, no, knows what it is. But my conscious mind doesn't get that far. I only know I have to get to it. I hear indistinct shouting behind me. The two surviving green shirts are coming after me, moving swiftly now that the sand is solid, the heat gone, the land still, and the air gentle. I don't care. I have to get to the horizon. Something primitive and atavistic in me has taken over. The very sand beneath my feet changes. It's no longer thick, rolling dunes of desert, but a sprinkling of sand over something else. I kick at the sand as I run. Earth. Black, rich dirt, of the kind no one in Eden has ever seen. Wild dirt. Laughing as I run, I want to roll in it, rub it on my arms, taste it. But ahead of me, the green smudge is resolving itself into something wonderful. How long do I run? A mile? 2 miles? Over land that until recently was desert. But I see now, it was a fake desert. False like so many things in Eden. Where the breeze blows sand away, I see the grates of what can only be heaters, now cool and dead. They must have been elevating the temperature, creating a desert environment where none existed. To keep humans from venturing out into the dead, barren land, I would have guessed once. To keep us safe from the poisons we put into our own world. That was before I saw the forest. It makes a mockery of the fake beanstalk woods. When I first saw them, I thought they were glorious, because I had no grounds for comparison. Even the camphor, huge and lovely and unbelievable as it may be, is sad compared to what I'm looking at right now. The camphor is a tree out of place, trapped as I was trapped my whole life. They've done wonders keeping it alive, thriving even. But how can a tree be a proper tree imprisoned underground? I'm standing in grass, as high as my knees, shot through with flowers and scratchy seed heads. There's a low buzzing sound, and I think another tremor is starting. But no, it is only a bee flying sleepily from flower to flower. Beyond the little field of grass, the forest springs up abruptly, thick and dark. Birds flit through the boughs. There's a movement to one side. An animal, as tall as I am, slenderly made and elegant, steps carefully on small, sharp hooves, testing the air with its black nose. Antlers branch from its brow. It smells me, but doesn't seem to see me. I'm perfectly still. And it can't have ever seen my kind in all its lifetime. Everything I've read about, seen illustrated in data blocks, animated in vids, it exists, right before my eyes. This isn't another vision. It's not a trick. The trick was keeping it from us. Has the world been healed all this time? Why didn't they tell us? Do they even know? I want Lachlan to see this. And Lark. And oh, my mother. What I wouldn't give to have her standing beside me, gazing at what we all thought was lost.